A middle-aged English professor stands at his office window, staring at an MMA gym across the street. He's stuck in academic limbo, his career stalled, his body softening. Then a thought strikes him. What if I walked through those doors? What would I discover about violence, about being a man, about myself? 2 years later, Jonathan Gottschall finds himself in a chain-link cage, facing a trained fighter while hundreds of people watch. His heart hammers. His daughters had begged him not to do this. One predicted he'd lose bad, the other worried he might die. Yet here he stands, about to test a question that has haunted human civilization since we first organized into societies. Can we understand violence without embracing it? Can we tame our most primal instincts through ritual rather than suppression? This journey would take him from academic theory to brutal physical reality, forcing him to confront uncomfortable truths about human nature, masculinity, and our species' complex relationship with violence, truths that can't be wished away or socialized out of existence. Picture Alexander Hamilton in 1804, standing on the dueling grounds at Weehawken, New Jersey, the exact spot where his son Philip died 3 years earlier after refusing to apologize for a theater insult. Now, Alexander faces Aaron Burr with the same choice, apologize or die. Why would someone so intelligent choose such catastrophic irrationality? Because in honor cultures, reputation isn't abstract, it's survival. Without honor, Hamilton's legal practice would collapse, his political career would end, and his family would carry the stain for generations. He wasn't brave. He was terrified of social death. The duel's elaborate protocols actually civilized violence. Crucial delays between challenge and combat allowed rage to cool. Most duels ended peacefully. Victory came from showing up. This logic operates today in prisons, where inmates fight over trivial slights because not fighting marks you as pregay. As one prisoner's memoir states, failing to retaliate declares, "I am food." Gottschall faced his own version. When considering abandoning his fight, gym mates accused him of pussying out. Like Hamilton, he ultimately fought because he was too much of a coward not to, haunted by every time he'd back down from bullies. Watch two male chimpanzees square off at the San Diego Zoo. They don't immediately attack. Instead, they follow a script. Hard stares, aggressive vocalizations, chest displays, then maybe brief physical contact before one retreats. This monkey dance isn't unique to primates. From beetles to bears, species across the animal kingdom resolve conflicts through ritualized displays that rarely escalate to serious injury. Self-defense expert Rory Miller identified the human version: hard stare, verbal challenge, closing distance, chest bumping, then punching. Whether it's a bar fight in Boston or a schoolyard confrontation in Bangkok, the steps remain remarkably consistent. Yet, despite ritual combat's purpose of reducing harm, it remains a leading cause of male mortality. Studies show 50 to 70% of homicides begin as altercations of relatively trivial origin, arguments over parking spots, perceived disrespect, or whose turn it is at the pool table. Even presidential debates follow primate rules. During the first 2012 debate, Romney's commanding body language contrasted sharply with Obama's downcast gaze, which signaled submission in primate terms. Here's a startling fact. We have twice as many female ancestors as male ancestors. Throughout human history, roughly half of all men died without passing on their genes, while successful males achieved extraordinary reproductive success. Genghis Khan has approximately 16 million male descendants alive today. Being male is an evolutionary high-stakes game where losers face genetic extinction and winners achieve immortality through their bloodlines. This pressure shaped male bodies into fighting machines. Men aren't just 20% heavier than women overall. They're 40% heavier in fat-free mass, 60% heavier in lean muscle, and 80% heavier in arm muscle. The upper body strength difference is staggering. Only 1 in 1,000 women can outlift the average man. Cross-cultural studies spanning 30 diverse societies show remarkable consistency. Men are universally perceived as more active, adventurous, dominant, and forceful. Boys establish clear dominance hierarchies based on strength and athletic ability, with social status at age 6 remarkably predictive of standing in young adulthood. These hierarchies aren't arbitrary cruelty, they're training grounds for adult male competition.
Gottschall's karate training unraveled when he asked his sensei about ground defense. The dismissive response, "just don't get taken down," revealed how traditional martial arts avoid uncomfortable questions. Kyokushin karate operated like a cult centered on Mas Oyama, the god hand, who allegedly killed a yakuza with one punch and fought bulls barehanded. Investigation revealed these stories as fabrications, a pattern where martial arts founders achieved divine status. The martial arts publishing industry amplified these fantasies, promising mind reading and psychic powers, transforming Asian martial arts into quasi-religious systems that resisted scientific testing. Early UFC events shattered these myths. Royce Gracie, at 170 pounds, defeated larger opponents using Brazilian jiu-jitsu, exposing striking arts limitations. Yet even Gracie's dominance proved temporary. Once opponents learned BJJ, American wrestlers emerged dominant. This evolution demonstrated how practical, tested methods ultimately prevail over traditional systems that resist empirical validation.
Sport is ritualized combat, the monkey dance refined. Like gazelles in strength contests, humans use sports to demonstrate prowess safely. For men, forming groups meant survival, but so did competing within them. Sports evolved as nature's solution, intense competition without destroying social bonds. This explains why men transform roughhousing into affection. When Gottschall's brother tackled him at an airport, it meant, "I love you, but I hardly see you." Athletes enjoy greater sexual success because status signals desirable traits. Women are attracted to athletic physiques, broad shoulders, swollen muscles, because they signal formidability and protection. Unlike men seeking reproductive cues, women select mates based on production cues, ability to do work. Sports fandom activates tribal instincts. Roman chariot racing inspired such devotion that fans examined horse dung and divided into color-coded factions that rioted violently. Team sports generate more passion than individual sports because they trigger tribal psychology, explaining why MMA crowds are tamer than football fans.
Men consistently prefer violent entertainment more than women, a pattern emerging in childhood and persisting across cultures. Despite gender-neutral toy initiatives, boys gravitate toward combat scenarios while girls show opposite preferences, suggesting biological rather than purely social origins. Real warriors describe war's confusing duality, simultaneously hellish and heavenly. Combat veterans report extreme fear and grief alongside feeling more alive than ever. Vietnam veteran William Broyles Jr. described war as perhaps the great love of their lives. Soldiers from Robert E. Lee to Vietnam veterans compare battle's intensity to sexual pleasure, not because combat is arousing, but because sex offers the only comparable intensity. Gottschall's coach explained, "A fighter may be the nicest guy on the street, but once he's in a fight, he has to like it." After landing a devastating kick on a sparring partner, Gottschall feels both apologetic and secretly pleased. Physically dominating another man proves intoxicating and deeply satisfying, forcing him to confront uncomfortable truths about male nature and our species' complex relationship with violence.
47 seconds. That's how long Gottschall's fight lasted before he tapped out. 15 months of training, 12 pounds lost, ending in less than a minute. Driving home at midnight, nursing his aching arm and gorging on gas station food, he reflects on the humiliation. Tapping out means, "Please stop. I admit you are the better man." Yet something profound happened in that cage. His 6-year-old had begged, "Please don't, Daddy. I don't want you to die." On fight night, his fear had dissipated. He felt tough and capable, having proven he could take a punch and keep fighting. The outcome mattered less than the transformation. After the fight, he met opponent Justin in the stands.
They shared beers, a ritual reminiscent of 17th century Amsterdam duelists who would drink away their troubles after knife fights. Despite chronic injuries, Gottschall continues training because fighting is a good drug that makes life more intense. I'm not ready to slide down off the steeps of life, down, down to the long, dull flats. The cage taught him that violence isn't something to simply suppress or celebrate, but to understand and channel. We carry ancient instincts for dominance shaped by millions of years of competition. The question isn't whether we have these drives, but what we do with them. Let them explode in bar fights, or channel them through ritual and controlled challenge.